Hey there, welcome to LiveWire. I'm your host, Luke Burbank. This week, we are talking to renowned chef and author Kenji Lopez-Ault about his cooking journey, which started at one of those Mongolian grill restaurants where you fill up a bowl with like raw meat and vegetables and they grill it for you. These days, he's got a new book out, The Wok, Recipes and Techniques. And we're also going to quiz him, food god that he is, on real infomercials for weird kitchen gadgets. Then we're going to hear some stand-up from the very funny Sarah Schaefer, who is not only going to be doing stand-up, but is going to teach the rest of us non-comedians how to do comedy. And finally, we're going to wrap things up with a musical performance from one of my daughter's favorite indie rock bands, and also mine. Can I get some cool points, please? Dead is their name, but their music is anything but. So that's the plan. Don't go anywhere. LiveWire gets started right after this.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
This episode of LiveWire is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you can call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. This episode of LiveWire was originally recorded in January of 2023. We hope you enjoy it. Let's get to the show. Hey, Elena.
Hey, Luke. How's it going?
It's going well. I see you're flying your Pittsburgh Steelers terrible towel in your studio today.
I'm in my work office, and I have my terrible towel so that I appear like a grounded human.
Uh-huh. Sure. Hey, you ready to do the station location identification examination?
Oh, yeah, sure. I hope it's Pittsburgh.
Oh, I mean, that accent actually sort of sounded a little bit like where we're talking about. This is the part of the show where I quiz Elena on a radio station that LiveWire is on in the country. She's got to guess where I'm talking about. At one point, this city held the Guinness World Record for most bars and nightclub on one street.
Green Bay, Wisconsin.
You're in the right state. You can see the Mississippi River, Minnesota, Iowa, and Wisconsin from the legendary Granddad Bluff in this city.
La Crosse, Wisconsin.
Elena Passarello, you are a marvel. It is exactly La Crosse, Wisconsin, where we're on the air on WLSU Radio.
Woohoo!
I had another hint that I think would have been a dead giveaway because you're such a bird enthusiast. Is that a, what do they call that? Ornithophile or something?
Yeah.
It's known as the birdwatcher's paradise because you can find bald eagles, tundra swans, great egrets, bluebirds, warblers, and sparrows.
Oh, I love all those.
Yeah, sounds like your kind of town. Shout out to everyone listening at WLSU in La Crosse. All right, should we get to the show?
Let's do it.
Take it away.
From PRX, it's this week, chef and author Kenji Lopez-Ault.
That's like one of my favorite infomercial lines ever. Stop having a boring tuna, stop having a boring life.
And comedian Sarah Schaefer.
Do you know how hard it is to build a dollhouse without being able to shop at Hobby Lobby on principle? These people played a direct role in taking away our bodily autonomy, but they have such an incredible selection of glues. My God!
With music from Dead and our fabulous house band. I'm your announcer, Elena Passarello, and now, the host of LiveWire, Luke Burbank!
Hey, thank you so much, Elena Passarello. Thanks to everyone for tuning in from all over the country, including beautiful La Crosse, Wisconsin. Folks on WLSU. We've got a great show in store for you this week. We have a listener question. We asked The LiveWire listeners, what is your most ambitious DIY project? We're going to hear those responses coming up in a few minutes. First, though, of course, we got to kick things off with the best news we heard all week.
Best news.
This is our little reminder at the top of the show that there is some good news happening out there in the world. Elena, what is the best news you heard this week?
Okay, so this is one of those best newses that starts out really not best.
Okay.
Sounds kind of worst, but it gets better.
Okay.
So there is a plant disease that is ravaging the olive trees of Italy.
Oh, no.
It's not that great. It's called Xylella, and it's really affecting the region of Puglia in Italy, where 50% of Italy's olive oil is produced.
Oh, no.
It's attacking trees that are like hundreds of years old. And it's a relatively new disease to Italy, but it's actually happened all over the world, including to certain vineyards in California. It's just this bacteria or disease or something that kind of suffocates the plants. And it's spread by hungry spittle bugs. And they bite one plant and they get their spit in there and then they take it to another plant and they bite that plant. And it's just awful. It's spreading through Italy at like 12 miles a year. And you control it by uprooting the plants entirely. But the problem is humans have a really hard time detecting if a plant has this disease at its early stages. So a couple of years ago, there's a guy who's an olive manufacturer who used to be an Italian policeman where he worked with drug-sniffing dogs.
Okay.
This guy's name is Nicola Di Nola. And so then he called basically the Italian version of the American Kennel Club. So he's like, which breeds would be best for being trained to detect this scent of this disease? And they were like, Springer Spaniel, Cocker Spaniel, Lab. So I read this amazing article in the BBC about this adorable lab named Paco, who is now able to detect. You can't see it, you can't smell it, you can't taste it. If you're a human, it is completely not detectable to you. But Paco and other dogs like Paco are learning how to monitor all of the crops of Italy. So basically, I can get my olive oil and bread dip whenever I need it, which is really the most important news for me.
That was exactly where my brain went, the Evo. If I don't have my Evo, if I don't have my extra virgin olive oil, I'm in a lot of trouble. So I'm glad to hear that.
I get evil if I don't get my Evo. So thank you, Paco.
All right, the best news that I heard this week, this is right out of the Elena Passarello files. And
ooh.
I'm honestly, I'm sorry that I deprived you of it because like it's birds in the news.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
I feel like it's really, that's your brand. I cannot tell you how much this story warmed my heart. It's from Austria, where a biologist named Johannes Fritz has been working to save a species of bird called the northern bald ibis. Now, the northern bald ibis nearly went extinct. In fact, there weren't any of them living in the wild when Johannes Fritz was born. He's 56, by the way. They had been hunted so extensively in Europe that there was just a few hundred of them. They were living in captivity. But Johannes saw that movie, Fly Away Home, with Jeff Daniels and Anna Paquin.
Yes,
you remember
yes,
that one?
One of my faves.
Where they teach Canada geese how to migrate the proper way with that ultralight. This guy, Johannes Fritz, saw that and he goes, I'm going to do that with the northern bald ibis. And he says that everyone thought he was crazy. They're like, that's just a movie. He's like, no, I think I can do it. He had to learn how to fly.
He wasn't a pilot ahead of time.
He was not. And in fact, he would get sick when he was in a glider. He had motion sickness. And one of the things, too, is they had to modify this kind of ultralight that he's in so that it didn't fly so fast that the birds couldn't keep up with it. And I'm not a Wright brother, but I know there's a certain amount of speed you need while airborne to stay airborne. He apparently figured out how he could go like 25 miles an hour so that the birds could keep up with him. So he gets these ibises, which some describe as the ugliest birds on earth, which of course, you know, immediately means I love them.
Right.
Like makes them my favorite bird that's ever lived. So he teaches them how to migrate. He flies this thing. They follow him and the ibises are doing fine for a period of years, and then, because of climate change, their migratory route they had been using is no longer viable for them because of various things involving the temperature of the air and updrafts and things. And so he bribed them with a bunch of mealworms and got them into like a truck and drove them on their migratory path so they would survive. But he realized this was not a sustainable model. So he figured out a new route for them. And so he's been raising these ibises, a group of them, since they were chicks. So they're very bonded with him and his associates. And they just recently took their flight where they got them all out in a field. And then he's on this like weird airplane thing. And his associate, one of his research colleagues, the one that the ibises really identify with, she's also sitting on this flying contraption backwards looking at the birds. So they know that. Like
that it's her.
That it's her because they're very bonded with her. And if she's on this weird flying contraption, they know that it's okay for them to follow it. They just did their like inaugural flight and they actually got them all the way down to Italy eventually, which is where these birds go on their migration.
Whoa, sounds nice.
Right. So it actually worked. And I thought this was such an amazing thing because like this guy had to watch the Jeff Daniels movie. He had to learn how to operate a light aircraft. He had to get over his motion sickness.
He had to find like-minded friends, birds of a feather, if you will, to help him with this project.
We will. And then, thanks to climate change, the route didn't work anymore, and he didn't just give up. He went out and found a new route. He's doing the whole thing again. He told the New York Times, "This is not so much a job," he added, "but my life's purpose."
Oh, my God.
I mean, it's just absolutely adorable, rooting for those ibises, and that's the best news I heard all week. Let's welcome our first guest on over to the show. He's a chef and wildly popular New York Times food columnist. He's also the best-selling author of The Food Lab and the host of the YouTube series Kenji's Cooking Show, which has over 1 million subscribers. His latest cookbook, The Wok, Recipes and Techniques, is available now. Take a listen to this. It's our conversation recorded at Town Hall in Seattle with Kenji Lopez-Ault here on LiveWire.
Hi.
Kenji, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Now, you're one of those classic chefs that studied architecture at MIT.
Right.
When did you actually get into food?
So I started getting into food the summer after my sophomore year of college when I was quitting biology because I took organic chemistry and I hated that.
Yep.
So that summer I was going through this, you know, what am I going to do with my career? And so I needed to make money. So I was looking for a job as a server. And then a restaurant I walked into was like, we have a prep cook who didn't show up this morning. So if you can start today, you can have a job as a cook for the summer. So I was like, okay, I'll do that.
Do you remember what you were doing first days in the kitchen?
Yeah, I remember my very first day when I the question they asked me was, do you know how to hold a knife? And I said, yes, but I didn't really. And I was slicing oranges for the bar, and one of the prep cooks comes over to me and just stands there shaking his head. And so he showed me how to hold a knife properly and how to slice an orange, and I had to practice on a lot of oranges. Yeah, it was at a all you can eat Mongolian grill type place.
Yeah. Is that the kind with the big grill where you bring the bowl of your stuff and they just put it on a section of the grill?
Yeah, it's like pre-COVID days. Oh, yeah. You go to the raw meat bar where everyone's like poking around.
Whatever.
And then I started as a prep cook, and within 2 weeks I was a knight of the round grill. So.
Whoa, wow. And that was your title.
And then after working in restaurants, that's when I started to sort of get into eating food, and I was like, oh, this is like interesting. Before that, I was a pretty picky eater, especially like going out at restaurants. I didn't want anything interesting. And so I started learning how to cook, and then I was like, oh, this is a whole new world of stuff to appreciate, and then got into food after that.
Your grandfather was a chemist?
Organic chemist, yeah.
Now, do you feel like that sort of in your DNA that you were programmed to want to really get into food on a more kind of molecular and scientific level?
I don't think interest in science is genetically passed down.
That's not epiphenomenal.
but certainly like my grandfather was a chemist and my dad was a biologist, and so there was a lot of sort of science conversation at the dinner table. So in that sense, yeah, I think it definitely got passed down to some degree.
Your first cookbook was this huge hit. What do you attribute that to? Was it just that you were able to help people understand how to make some relatively simple stuff just a lot better using science?
No, I mean, I think a lot of it is like being in the right place at the right time, just like being really lucky. When I started cooking, there wasn't really, I mean, there was an internet, but there wasn't even like YouTube, anything like that. And then, you know, and so I learned how to cook in restaurants, and then I went into the writing world, and then I kind of came along the writing world, and my career as a writer kind of paralleled the shift from paper to online media, and got really lucky to fall into like those early sets of like sort of food blogs that became popular and finding a platform on Serious Eats. You know, the, as far as the book goes, the way I thought about it was that, you know, I didn't come into cooking until much later in my life compared to a lot of chefs I know, you know, who like maybe they had parents who cooked or they have the food of their people. And, you know, it's like I didn't come into food that way. I came into it as like a summer job. And then I wanted to learn about it. You know, so for me as a cook in restaurants, like I did have a lot of questions about like why things worked the way they did and whether I could make my life easier by if I did it a slightly different way. You know, so when I wrote that first book, I was kind of thinking, yeah, if somebody wrote a book for me when I was 19 or whatever and wanted to like not waste so much time poorly peeling boiled eggs, what would that book look like? And so that's what that first book kind of was.
What's the key to effectively peeling boiled eggs?
You start them in hot water. So like it's
that's science.
Like, yeah, I mean like thousands of eggs worth of testing on this. Yeah.
You heard it here first on LiveWire. Okay, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, though, I want to ask how an infomercial may have led directly or indirectly sure. to this latest yeah. book of yours. We're talking to Kenji Lopez-Alt here on LiveWire, back with much more in a moment. Welcome back to LiveWire from Town Hall in Seattle. I'm Luke Burbank here with Elena Passarello. We're talking to Kenji Lopez-Alt, the food writer and YouTube host, about his latest book. It's called The Wok, Recipes and Techniques. Now, is it true that your interest in The Wok really came from seeing an infomercial about kitchen gadgets or something?
It was an infomercial about woks, yeah.
Specifically woks.
Yeah, yeah.
And what were they doing on there that you found compelling?
Well, it was like a very British guy calling it the Great Wok of China.
Oh, nice. Casually racist.
Yeah, and a lot of steaming when there was supposed to be stir frying going. But the selling point of this wok was that it was like hand hammered, and they showed this footage of like where the people were making the woks in these factories, and they're like hammering them into tree stumps to mold them, and I was like, oh, that's pretty cool. But anyhow, I watched a lot of infomercials as a kid, and that one always kind of stuck out to me as like, oh, we actually have this one in our kitchen.
When in your cooking life, once you know, realized this is what you wanted to do and you're starting to really look into food and write about food, did you start to use a wok more?
The wok was one of the few things that my mom cooked a lot of. She came here from Japan. She cooked a lot of Japanese and sort of Sino-Japanese food in a wok. So I was familiar with the tool, and particularly like deep frying. She always did that in a wok. So I was familiar with the tool growing up. But I bought myself a wok when I was in college. So right after I started cooking. So I bought it at a Target in Somerville for $20. And that same wok, up until this book was published in March, and that wok was like fully functional until like April or so. Wow.
The one you bought at Target.
Yeah, 20 years. So, I mean, because I cooked for, you know, it's like I cooked in college. I cooked like when I was after college living with roommates and, you know, like when it was just me and my wife and now my family. So, you know, so it's like a tool that, honestly, it's like has spent like every stove I've ever had, like at least 60% of the time, like there's that wok was sitting on it.
Wow.
You know? So it's a tool that, you know, like this entire book, there's only like one or two recipes that call for anything other than just a wok on a stovetop. And so, you know, whether you're learning how to cook or whether you're trying to learn a new style of cooking or familiarize yourself with a very ancient and well-researched style of cooking, it's a cheap investment.
I, like a lot of folks, bought a wok at some point, tried it a few times. It never
gave me, or I never got the effect I was going for, didn't taste like the stuff I had been eating in a restaurant that was cooked in a wok.
Right.
What are people like me probably doing kind of wrong in that scenario?
Well, so a couple things. The first one is that...
how much more time in the show do we have for me to list the ways you're bad at this, Burbank?
No. So the first one I think is that you're trying to get exactly what you get at a restaurant, you know, which is it's a goal, it's an achievable goal, but it's not necessarily, I think, the first goal you should have with the wok, you know, and particularly like ones that have like a lot of like wok hay, like the smoky, like getting the flame in there, like that's a technique that takes some practice and also some specialized equipment to do at a restaurant scale. And then that said, in the book, I talk about a few ways you can try and get some of those restaurant flavors. So in particular, like a lot of it comes down to cooking in smaller batches. And instead of trying to do what they do on the infomercial, like where you just add like tons and tons of stuff until it's like all the way at the top and just steaming.
That was literally exactly what I did. I probably bought, you know, like $40 worth of like vegetables, meats, and everything. And it was for an army. And yeah, I'm just like, my bird like arms can't even like toss this thing on my dorm stove. We're talking to Kenji Lopez Alt about his latest book, The Wok: Recipes and Techniques. Okay. Now, as you mentioned in the book, and as we've been talking about, your kind of first little bit of interest in the wok was from an infomercial advertising it. And so we wanted to test your knowledge of some other infomercials about culinary contraptions. Okay. This is a game we're calling Inspect Your Gadgets.
Okay. Yeah.
Inspect Your Gadgets.
All right. The LiveWire House Band, by the way. Now, here's how this is going to work, Kenji. Okay. I'm going to play you a snippet of an actual infomercial.
Okay.
And
all
you
right.
have to
and
try
all food
to.
Related.
These are all, yeah, these okay. are these are infomercials yeah. for like food based items.
Okay.
Okay, things in the kitchen. Okay, so here's the first one. What do you think this is an infomercial for, a real food thing?
I used to use a fork.
Get the fork out of here. Now you just grip it, dip it, flip it.
And the best part is
your fingers stay clean.
Jeez, is that I don't know. Is it for like shredding barbecue claws?
You know, this would work with that. This is for a product, a real thing called trongs.
Oh, okay.
Trongs are these little, like, you know those like wax, like vampire teeth you get when you're a kid, like, you know, for Halloween. They're like that, but you put them on your fingers, and they're made of like food safe, plastic. And when you're eating hot wings or something, the juice doesn't get on your actual fingers. It gets on the trongs.
Okay.
And if you watch the full ad, the guy literally says, have you ever been eating wings? And then you realize you can't shake anyone's hand.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is a product that was created when a person realized that he couldn't shake enough hands immediately after eating wings.
Right, because when you see the guy eating wings with trongs on their fingers, you don't go close enough to shake their hand.
Right, exactly. It solves the problem, but not in the intended way. Right. All right, trongs were the most obscure. Okay, that was the hardest one probably.
Okay.
So this one was a little more widely embraced. This is another actual snippet of an infomercial for a food product.
This thing, this tuna, looks boring. Having a boring tuna.
Stop having a boring life.
Add this tuna, put it here like this.
Whoa.
Now you're going to have
you're gonna
a
love
nice
my nuts.
Tuna salad. Look at this. You're going to have an exciting life now.
Who is that?
This is the Slap Chop.
It is absolutely the Slap Chop.
That's like one of my favorite infomercial lines ever. Stop having a boring tuna, stop having a boring life.
That's Vince, right?
Yeah,
that
guy went to jail for biting someone, I think.
That's right.
No,
that's right.
In fairness, he grabbed them with his trunks. Was actually later the court was fine.
You should have slap chopped them.
That whole ad is like riddled with entendre, like you said, Kenji. Like he's like chopping up nuts, and he's like, "You're gonna like my nuts." Yep. He was like the bad boy of infomercials, Vince. I bought a slap chop.
Yeah, how'd it work?
Terribly. The problem was, so if you weren't familiar,
life is still boring. Right?
It was kind of, the tuna was the least of my problems. It was like a kind of a plunger thing that had a knife on the bottom that was kind of S-shaped, mm-hmm. and it had a kind of a plastic cylinder around it. And the idea was you'd put it over your thing of onions, and you just slap it down, and it would just like chop the onions, and you wouldn't cry. The problem was the thickness of the blade.
Yeah.
It was not a blade. It was a flat piece of metal that was like a quarter inch thick. So it just would mash. I mean, it made the tuna more boring.
Yeah.
Impossibly. But it's the only one of those things I've ever purchased because the ads were that convincing to me. I thought it was really going to change my life. Okay. Here comes another one. Can you identify this?
Are you tired of fussing with giant pasta pots, strainers, timers, stirring, and testing just for a plate of pasta?
Well, I've got the solution for you. Hi.
I'm Kathy Buddy. I have to finish that line because she was the lady doing all of the infomercials for a while. Kathy Buddy.
Is it a spaghetti-shaped thermometer that you throw at the ceiling?
Wow. Oh, my God. That is $1 million idea. Yeah. Yeah. That is not what this is, but that, my friend, is $1 million. This is why you have 500,000 Instagram followers. No, yeah. It is a pasta boat.
Okay.
It was a boat-shaped thing that you would put pasta in and water and then put it in the microwave.
Oh, geez.
And microwave all of your pasta.
Nice. I think David Chang sells that now.
Yeah.
Isn't that just a bowl?
No, Elena. Bowls are cumbersome and they fall out of the cupboard on you. As for some reason, the screen turns to black and white for that section. Like, the easiest thing that we've all been doing, but now if you just film it right, it looks like it's the bane of everyone's existence.
Black and white.
Have you ever bought one of these extremely kind of silly kitchen gadgets?
You know, I was just remembering like a month ago of a time when we tested a bunch of like the most ridiculous hamburger products you could find. So there's one called the hot dogger where it's like a hot dog shaped mold, so you can put hamburger into it and shape it like a hot dog. And it's like if you run out of hamburger buns, but you still have hot dog buns.
Oh, that's so
good. Honestly, that's a good idea.
I love that.
Kenji Lopez Alt, the new book is The Wok, Recipes and Techniques. Thanks for coming on LiveWire.
Thanks for having me.
That was Kenji Lopez Alt, right here on LiveWire, recorded at Town Hall in Seattle. His latest book is The Wok, Recipes and Techniques. Hey, special thanks this week to Chris Bright of Portland, Oregon. Chris is part of the LiveWire member community and is generously supporting our program with a donation each month, which we are extremely appreciative of, because it's how we're able to do this show each week. So a huge thanks to Chris Bright for keeping LiveWire going. This is LiveWire. Of course, each week we ask our LiveWire listeners a question in honor of Kenji and our upcoming guest, Sarah Schaefer's extreme DIY abilities. We asked our listeners, tell us about your most ambitious DIY project. Elena has been collecting up those responses. What are you seeing?
How about this one from Brian? Brian says, I have never built anything before, and I built a 2-level chicken coop that could be opened from the outside and you could pull out the eggs. It is the one and only time I have used the Pythagorean theorem as an adult.
Wow. And that worked. And by the way, Brian is laughing all the way to the bank. Have you seen how expensive eggs are right now?
That's right. Yeah, no, like that Pythagorean theorem really paid off in terms of this avian flu egg shortage, huh?
I was too busy investing in crypto, and my friends that were building chicken coops knew where the real money was. What's another DIY project that one of our listeners took on?
Sort of a different topic from Claire. Claire's biggest DIY project, having children and trying to make them into decent people.
Tell you what, you never stop D-ing that IY. I know, as a parent of someone in their 20s, it is a lifelong journey.
Doesn't it just turn into DIT, like they got to do it themselves or
well,
no?
Well, ideally, Elena, ideally. What's one more before we move on?
Speaking of parents, what do you think about this one from Lynn? Lynn's most ambitious DIY project, helping my daughter photograph the undead.
Photograph the undead, i.e. ghosts, I guess, right?
Yeah.
Wow.
Is it a science project at a very liberal school in terms of what science is?
I watch all of those shows where they're like ghost hunting, and I really want there to be ghosts. I want them to have some evidence, but it's always just kind of like a little blip on the audio recorder and everybody kind of freaks out.
I'm very happy to not hunt or photograph or, I mean, they may be out there, but you know what? I'm not going to look. Like, I'm fine on my own.
You know, let those sleeping ghosts lie is kind of your policy.
Amen to that. Yes.
All right. Thank you to everyone who sent in those responses to our listener question this week. Let's welcome our next guest on over to the show. Sarah Schaefer is a critically acclaimed comedian, writer, and producer. She was the co-host of MTV's late night show, Nikki and Sarah Live. She won 2 Emmys for her work at Late Night with Jimmy Fallon. And she joined us on stage at Revolution Hall in Portland recently. And just a quick note before we get to this performance, it is a little visual in some instances, particularly a puppet makes an appearance. You remember that, Elena?
Oh, yeah. I can't forget that puppet.
Our technical director, Molly Pettit, brought a puppet out on stage. I don't want to say anything more. I don't want to ruin it for you. So just take a listen to this. It's Sarah Schaefer here on LiveWire.
Hello. Hello, everyone. Hello. So good to be here. I have to set this up. I'm doing a solo show for you tonight. It's about 90 minutes. No, I'm working on this solo show. It's called Going Up. And the premise of the show is it's a fake seminar about how to make it in comedy. And I'd like to do a little portion of it for you tonight, if that's okay with you. Okay. Because I can feel it. There's a lot of people in this room that are lost. And you're looking for purpose. That purpose? Comedy. But Sarah, I already have a career. I'm a dental hygienist. You were a dental hygienist. Your new life has now begun. So if you're going to make it in comedy, pretty early on, you're going to want to decide on your brand. What type of comedian are you going to be? Now, there's lots of different styles of comedy to choose from, and I'm going to demonstrate them for you right now by telling a joke in each style along one specific topic. Quick note about topics. Now, when you're working on something creative, maybe you've heard the phrase, write what you know. Write what you know. Well, in Comediosity, we take it a step further. Not only do we write what we know, we write what everybody else knows. We pick those big, broad topics that everybody can relate to. Food, family, relationships, the differences between men and women along the cis-heteronormative binary, right? So you're going to want to pick a very big, broad topic. For this demonstration, I'm going to pick a topic that not only do I know, but that everyone else knows, and that is miniatures and dollhouses. Here we go. First up, standard comedian. You've seen a few. Here's a standard comedian, standard joke. I love miniatures and dollhouses, and I know you might look at me and not immediately think that. You might, you know, because normally we associate dollhouses and miniatures with like grandmas and ghosts, right? But I do have the muscle tone and overall demeanor of a grandma, and I am dead. I have been dead ever since Beyonce played Coachella. I died. I literally died. So that's like a standard joke, right? So then we have your one-liner. One-liner comic. Man, miniatures. I love a tiny thing. But my husband asked me to stop calling it that. See? It's a one-liner. Then we have the misdirection comic. Now, you might not have heard that term before, misdirection. But once I demonstrate it for you, you'll get it. Here's a misdirection comic. And this is actually true. I am officially a first-time homeowner. Yeah, thank you. It's a dollhouse. Anyway, I have very little money. I keep it in a matchbox. It's adorable. And you just keep going. Never finish the sentence. Just keep changing directions. That's misdirection. You know what I'm talking about now. You're starting to get it. And we have storyteller. Here's a quick story. I was recently shopping for miniature supplies at one of my favorite places to shop, Joann's. If you've been to Joann's, you know about Joann's, right? We got a few, come on. NPR crowd, come on. We're spending hours in Joann's. Joann's is a great store for crafting supplies. It's where you can shop for crafting stuff right alongside other women literally named Joann. And Joannes are kind of like Karens, right? Except instead of being motivated by racism, they're motivated by coupons. Very fine line. Very fine line. Now, whenever I go to Joannes, it's always the same thing, right? You know, you've been there. You know what I'm talking about. It's a long line, and one register is open. And it's always being held up by one Joanne. She's up at the front. And for some reason, she's not done shopping yet. She's running back into the aisles to get more stuff. And if you know, if you shop there a lot, yeah, I'm doing it. I'm doing a full half hour of jokes on Joannes right now. Joannes, if you know if you shop there, you know what's going on. She was trying to use the coupon, the one, the main one we all love. Spend $35, get $5 off. Great value. But she gets up to the front and she didn't meet the threshold. She didn't get out the calculator. She didn't realize the sales and now she's screwed. So she's running back in the aisles to get more stuff to try to get over the line. But that's not what we agreed to. We made a silent agreement. You get up to the front, and if you don't get over the line, you got two choices. You abort the mission, or you're grabbing whatever's in arm's reach to get over the line. You're buying three bottles of blueberry muffin hand soap, or those are your only two options. Right? So that's a story. And then we have poignant solo show comic. Solo show comic, though. Tell that same story, but at the very end, they'll add one really harrowing, messed up detail from their life. Whatever the worst thing that's ever happened to you, use it. Mine your trauma. Add it on, just tack it on at the end and do the whole story with new meaning. So for instance, you tell that same whole story and at the end, you say something like, and that's when I was attacked by my seasonal allergies. Blackout, standing ovation, critical acclaim, Netflix special, Emmy Awards. Then you have your crowd work comic. Who's out there? You two together? Answer me, you two. No, yes. You're the miniaturist of the household. It's you.
Her mom.
Oh, wow. Are you going to let him talk to you that way? What scale are you working in? What scale are you working in? I'm not going to leave until you answer me. 1/10 of an inch. Wow, bold. I'm more of a 1/12 myself. What's your favorite fraction? See, this is when you just become best friends with one lady in the audience. Personally, I'm a 3/8 girl myself. When you do crowd work, you really want to listen. You know, don't just force your stuff onto them. And we have political comedian, only 20 more examples, hold on. Political comedian. You know how hard it is to be a miniaturist and a feminist at the same time? Why? Two words, Hobby Lobby. Do you know how hard it is to build a dollhouse without being able to shop at Hobby Lobby on principle? These people played a direct role in taking away our bodily autonomy. But they have such an incredible selection of glues. My God! But you know what? Maybe I wouldn't even have to be shopping at Hobby Lobby. Because maybe if I could afford a real-sized house, I wouldn't have to build a dollhouse. But I can't because malignant capitalism has decimated the housing market. Am I right? Clap. All right, see, now that's something called clapter. That's when you fill the air with clapping instead of laughter by just saying something that you think the audience will agree with. Now, some people think that's a political thing. They think that's woke comics only use clapter, and they think it's a brand of comedy. But no, it's just a tool that all types of comedians use. And in fact, I would say that the type of comedian that makes fun of woke comedy, the type of comedian that makes fun of clapter, is kind of the one that uses it the most. And that, of course, is the edgelord, which I will now demonstrate for you. The edgelord. Oh, my son came up to me the other day.
he was like, "Daddy, Daddy, I want a dollhouse." And I was like, "No. What are you, a f***ing snowflake?" Oh, can't say that anymore, can I? What are you going to do, cancel me? Obviously. But you know what? I'm just saying what everybody's thinking. I hate my son. Clap, clap.
All right, there you go.
And we have the beloved puppet comic. For those listening at home, I have a puppet of myself. For some reason. Oh, hey, Jessica, what are you doing today?
Oh, you know, I'm just playing with my miniatures.
Wait a minute. Why are you talking like that?
No, that's how I talk.
Why?
That's just how I...
But well, no, I don't think we should do that accent.
Why not?
Because it's just... I don't know how. It's just... It's. I feel like it's going to get racist. I don't think I should do that.
No, 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 no. No, Sarita. See, it's not racist. Because you're not saying it. I'm saying it.
No! Get away from me. And then finally we have, there are many other examples. Hopefully I'll be doing my show for you in Portland next year. So look for it. Finally, we have musical comedian. We didn't do a sound check, so it's their fault. All right. I love miniatures, yes I do. They are so tiny and so cute. But I think the real reason I love them is 'cause I'm in charge now, I'm in charge now. They're so little and I'm so big. They're so tiny, I could f***ing crush them. That's musical comics. So you're gonna wanna choose one of those. Thank you so much.
Thank you guys.
Sarah Schaefer, everyone.
That was Sarah Schaefer right here on Livewire, performing at Revolution Hall in Portland. I'm Luke Burbank right over there, Elena Passarella. We have to take a quick break, but don't go anywhere. We will be back with some incredible music from the band Dead that you do not want to miss. So stay with us. Livewire is thrilled to be partnering with Portland's own Portal Tea this season. Formerly known as Tea Chai Tay, Portal Tea is the premier tea company in the Pacific Northwest. They make one-of-a-kind, handcrafted tea blends like cinnamon churro chai and blueberry cream Earl Grey. Use the code LIVEWIRE, all lowercase, for 20% off at portaltea.co. Welcome back to Livewire from PRX. I'm Luke Burbank here with Elena Passarello. Okay, before we get to our musical guest this week, a little preview of next week's show. We are going to be talking to Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and acclaimed novelist Hector Tobar. His latest book is Our Migrant Souls, a meditation on race and the meanings and myths of Latino. We're also going to talk to comedian and filmmaker Jenna Friedman. She created the show Indefensible on AMC and also Soft Focus on Adult Swim. She's worked on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, and she was nominated for an Academy Award for her work on Borat 2, subsequent movie film. Jenna's going to be talking about her latest book, Not Funny, Essays on Life, Comedy, Culture, etc. Spoiler, though, it is, in fact, very funny. And we've got music from the indie folk group and sister trio, Joseph. Of course, though, no episode of Livewire would be complete without a listener question. Elena, what are we asking the Livewire listeners for next week's show?
We want you to tell us about a time that you tried to be funny and totally failed.
I can just say, as a person who tries a lot of jokes that don't always work, you know, failure is an important part of the creative process. So,
yes.
So don't be embarrassed to tell us about a time that you tried to be funny and it failed. You can hit us up on Livewire Radio over on Twitter or Facebook or whatever they're calling Twitter now. It's at Livewire Radio. We're looking forward to getting your answer. In the meantime, our musical guest this week started out in Chicago. They're inspired by the likes of the Cocteau Twins, James Brown, and Dolly Parton. Their music has been streamed tens of millions of times. Their most recent album is Blue Skies, and it's available now. Take a listen to this. It's Dead here on Livewire. Emily and Jason from Dead, welcome to Livewire.
Woo-hoo.
What's up?
Hi, Luke.
Hi, thank you for doing this. There is a really great track off of the album Blue Skies, your latest album. It's called Bad Love, which coincides with something on your website that I noticed, which is the Bad Love Hotline. Can you kind of explain how all of that sort of works together?
Yeah, basically we've had this phone number for a couple years and used to just send like weird messages out to whoever would call. But then when we put this new record out, we thought it would be fun to entertain people's terrible dating love stories that they could call in and leave a message.
And those messages are like listed on the website. I was listening to some of them.
Yeah, I guess so. People would like call in with, like in the beginning of the campaign, it was like call in with your bad love stories, because everybody has terrible dating stories, I'm assuming. I know I do. And we thought it would be a fun way to, you know, bring levity into the lonely part of dating. And yeah, and I guess some of them are on the website, but people still call in, and I don't know what they're saying now. You know, every now and then we get a notification that there's
another... we've maybe kind of fixed everyone's problems. Everyone's really good.
They're just calling to thank us.
We noticed that there were no more bad dates happening anywhere in the world. I guess that was...
We're putting Tinder out of business.
That was us.
You're listening to Livewire Radio. I'm Luke Burbank here with Elena Passarella. We're talking to Jason and Emily from the band Dead. Speaking of... I guess how your songs get created. My daughter, Addie, is a huge fan of yours, has been to a lot of shows. I told her that we were going to get to talk to you. And she said this in text to me. She was like, I think it's really admirable how much they've committed to their own sound and just kind of seem to make art for themselves. And if other people are into it, so be it. But they don't have any pretentiousness. Is that, I mean, kind of what you're trying to do is just make the music that you like?
What up, Addie?
Yeah, Addie.
Nailed
Addie.
It.
I feel seen. Wow, what a badass. What a compliment. Yeah, we are definitely... I mean, I don't know if we're trying, because that would be like canceling it out, but we definitely are just simply vibing with ourselves. Like, we're friends, we make music, we like it. What we make happens to have a sound that people recognize, and we kind of stick to it.
I guess what I'm wondering about I was looking at Spotify and I was noticing that you have songs that are streamed like 7 million times. And then there are other songs that are streamed hundreds of thousands of times, which is still a lot of times. But is it hard to not look at that and then start writing in the direction of the things that are getting 7 million streams?
I think it's just mostly more about like what's exciting to us, you know?
Yeah.
And sometimes I guess you could see the numbers and I guess like have that thought for a second, but it's pretty easy to let it go because we're just trying to chase like what's interesting and feels relevant to us at the moment. So,
cause that seems to work out well. And like when you look at a song that has 7 million views, you're not looking at the whole picture. It's like, well, it's relative to like, you know, the industry, the time that it came out, what people are into, like what trends are happening, algorithms, money, like there's so much that goes into it. Like it would be suicidal to be like, I'm going to put my self-worth into like views or streams or follows or even sales. It's like, yeah, it's easier to just stick with what we like and then just kind of roll with it. Obviously we know like, okay, well that song did well, like, you know, noted, but I don't think we make ourselves sick trying to reproduce something that other people saw as a hit, you know?
I was wondering, Emily, I was looking at the official Dead TikTok feed, which has literally two posts, and it's just you at a gym
oh my God.
Doing like crunches, trying to get people to call the Bad Love Hotline. But I noticed that I don't know if you still, but at that time you had braces. And I was wondering, does that affect how you sing? Does that change, like, actually the practice of singing for you?
That's so funny. Speaking of the TikTok, I didn't even know it was still there.
Do you still have the braces? I can't tell from here.
No. I have the braces are off. I have a gold tooth now. The braces did affect my singing, and you can hear it on some of the songs on this album because I had just gotten them when we were recording, and I have a slight lisp, which I thought was cool.
I love it.
And I leaned into it.
Yeah.
Does the gold tooth impact how it feels to sing, or is that just for a good look?
It was an accident. Like, the dentist, it was supposed to be a, you know, a tooth-colored tooth, and it came in, and he goes, I'm so sorry, it's gold. And I was like, screw it. Just put it in. It's good. Look at me. this is destiny. And he was, like, so excited and brought all his assistants in, and he took a selfie with me. He was like, this is amazing. He was, like, really stoked that I was, like, into a gold tooth because it's in the front of my mouth. He was like, nobody ever does this. I'm like, well, I'm not everybody.
Well, what song are we going to hear?
We're going to hear Love. Bad Love.
Yeah, the classic.
Playing the hits.
Fan favorite.
Yeah. Well, we're excited to hear it. This is Dead on Livewire.
I was a bad love. Now I can get some. I got a heart full of, I got a heart full of redemption. I was a bad love. Now I can get some. Run, baby, run, run from the bed of new love, baby. Come on, and give me some. Run, baby, run, run from the bed of new love, baby. Come on, and give me some. Give me some. Forgive me.
Dead right here on Livewire. That was great. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
That is going to do it for this week's episode of Livewire. A huge thanks to our guests, Kenji Lopez-Alt, Sarah Schaefer, and Dead.
Laura Haddon is our executive producer. Heather D. Michelle is our executive director. And our producer and editor is Melanie Sevchenko. Molly Pettit is our technical director, and our house sound is by D. Neil Blake. Trey Hester is our assistant editor and mixer. Our marketing and production manager is Karen Pan. Rosa Garcia is our operations associate. Jackie Ibarra is our production fellow, and Julian McElmurray is our intern. Our house band is Ethan Fox Tucker, Sam Tucker, A.L. Alves, and A. Walker Spring, who also composes our music.
Additional funding provided by the James F. and Marion L. Miller Foundation. Livewire was created by Robin Tenenbaum and Kate Sokoloff. This week, we'd like to thank member Chris Bright of Portland, Oregon. For more information about our show or how you can catch our podcast, head on over to livewireradio.org. I'm Luke Burbank for Elena Passarello and the whole Livewire crew. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next week. Dear Livewire, when we first met, I was really shy. I had no idea we'd spend so much time together or that you'd be one to fill my heart with joy and make me want to be a better person. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't know you were here. I was busy reading a review from one of our many, many rapturously smitten listeners. Oh, wait, actually, no, sorry, this is from Elena. Anyway, the point is, it would be really helpful if you wanted to leave us a review. Feel free to say really nice things about us, and we'll even read them now and then on the show, so you might hear your review of Livewire read on the program itself. Reviews help other people hear about the show, and then we can keep doing this for a long, long time, because we love having this job. Thank you so much if you've left a review, and if you're about to leave a review, you can go ahead and do it right where you get the podcast.
From PRX.